Disc 2.
I'm working on it, Abraham snapped, then abruptly left. I know you're busy, I said. Is that all you wanted, a blood check? Yeah, I guess. Any idea why he did it? He removed his red glasses, wiped them with a tissue, then rubbed his eyes. He was mentally ill, like a lot of these people. You spend years on the street, soaked with booze, stoned on crack, sleeping in the cold, getting kicked around by cops and punks. It makes you crazy. Plus, he had a bone to pick. The eviction. Yeah. A few months ago, he moved into an abandoned warehouse at the corner of New York and Florida. Somebody threw up some plywood, chopped up the place, and made little apartments. Wasn't a bad place, as far as homeless folk go. A roof, some toilets, water. $100 a month payable to an ex-pimp who fixed it up and claimed he owned it. Did he? I think so. He pulled a thin file from one of the stacks on his desk, and miraculously, it happened to be the one he wanted. He studied its contents for a moment. This is where it gets complicated. The property was purchased last month by a company called River Oaks, some big real estate outfit. And River Oaks evicted everyone. Yep. Odds are, then, that River Oaks would be represented by my firm. Good odds, yes. Why is it complicated? I've heard it secondhand that they got no notice before the eviction. The people claimed they were paying rent to the pimp, and if so, then they were more than squatters. They were tenants, thus entitled to due process. Squatters get no notice? None. And it happens all the time. Street folk will move into an abandoned building, and most of the time nothing happens, so they think they own it. The owner, if he's inclined to show up, can toss him without notice. They have no rights at all. How did Devon Hardy track down our firm? Who knows? He wasn't stupid, though. Crazy, but not stupid. Do you know the pimp? Yeah, completely unreliable. Where is the warehouse? Gone. They leveled it last week. I had taken enough of his time. He glanced at his watch. I glanced at mine. We swapped phone numbers and promised to keep in touch. Mordecai Green was a warm, caring man who labored on the streets protecting hordes of nameless clients. His view of the law required more soul than I could ever muster. On my way out, I ignored Sophia because she certainly ignored me. My Lexus was still parked at the curb, already covered with an inch of snow. Chapter 5. I drifted through the city as the snow fell. I couldn't recall the last time I had driven the streets of D.C. without being late for a meeting. I was warm and dry in my heavy luxury car, and I simply moved with the traffic. There was no place to go. The office would be off limits for a while, what with Arthur mad at me, and I'd have to suffer through 100 random drop-ins, all of which would start with the phony, "How you doing?" My car phone rang. It was Polly, panicky. "Where are you?" she asked. "Who wants to know?" "A lot of people. Arthur, for one, Rudolph. Another reporter called. There are some clients in need of advice. And Claire called from the hospital." "What does she want?" "She's worried, like everybody else." "I'm fine, Polly. Tell everybody I'm at the doctor's office." "Are you?" "No, but I could be." "What did Arthur say?" "He didn't call. Rudolph did. They were waiting for you." "Let him wait." A pause, then a very slow, "Okay. When might you be dropping by?" "Don't know. I guess whenever the doctor releases me." "Why don't you go home? We're in the middle of a storm. I'll call you tomorrow." I hung up on her. The apartment was a place I had rarely seen in the light of day, and I couldn't stand the thought of sitting by the fire and watching it snow. If I went to a bar, I'd probably never leave. So I drove. I flowed with the traffic as the commuters began a hasty retreat into the Maryland and Virginia suburbs, and I breezed along near empty streets coming back into the city. I found the cemetery near RFK where they buried the unclaimed, and I passed the Methodist Mission on 17th, where last night's uneaten dinner originated. I drove through sections of the city I had never been near, and probably would never see again. By 4, the city was empty. The skies were darkening, the snow was quite heavy. Several inches already covered the ground, and they were predicting another foot. Of course, not even a snowstorm could shut down Drake and Sweeney. I knew lawyers there who loved midnights and Sundays because the phones didn't ring. A heavy snow was a delightful respite from the grueling drudgery of nonstop meetings and conference calls. I was informed by a security guard in the lobby that the secretaries and most of the staff had been sent home at 3. I took Mister's elevator again. In a neat row in the center of my desk were a dozen pink phone messages, none of which interested me. I went to my computer and began searching our client index. River Oaks was a Delaware corporation, organized in 1977, headquartered in Hagerstown, Maryland. It was privately held, thus little financial information was available. The attorney was N. Braden Chance, a name unknown to me. I looked him up in our vast data bank. Chance was a partner in our real estate division somewhere down on the fourth floor. Age 44, married, law school at Duke, undergrad at Gettysburg, an impressive but thoroughly predictable resume. With 800 lawyers threatening and suing daily, our firm had over 36,000 active files. To make sure our office in New York didn't sue one of our clients in Chicago, each new file was entered immediately into our data system. Every lawyer, secretary, and paralegal at Drake and Sweeney had a PC, and thus instant access to general information about all files. If one of our probate attorneys in Palm Beach handled the estate of a rich client, I could, if I were so inclined, punch a few keys and learn the basics of our representation. There were 42 files for River Oaks, almost all of them real estate transactions in which the company had purchased property. Chance was the attorney of record on every file. 4 were eviction actions, 3 of which took place last year. The first phase of the search was easy. On January 31, River Oaks purchased property on Florida Avenue. The seller was TAG Incorporated. On February 4, our client evicted a number of squatters from an abandoned warehouse on the property, one of whom I now knew was Mr. Devon Hardy, who took the eviction personally and somehow tracked down the lawyers. I copied the file name and number and strolled to the fourth floor. No one joined a large firm with the goal of becoming a real estate lawyer. There were far more glamorous arenas in which to establish reputations. Litigation was the all-time favorite, and the litigators were still the most revered of all God's lawyers, at least within the firm. A few of the corporate fields attracted top talent. Mergers and acquisitions was still hot. Securities was an old favorite. My field, antitrust, was highly regarded. Tax law was horribly complex, but its practitioners were greatly admired. Governmental relations, lobbying, was repulsive, but paid so well that every D.C. firm had entire wings of lawyers greasing the skids. But no one set out to be a real estate lawyer. I didn't know how it happened. They kept to themselves, no doubt reading fine print in mortgage documents, and were treated as slightly inferior lawyers by the rest of the firm. At Drake and Sweeney, each lawyer kept his current files in his office, often under lock and key. Only the retired files were accessible by the rest of the firm. No lawyer could be compelled to show a file to another lawyer unless requested by a senior partner or a member of the firm's executive committee. The eviction file I wanted was still listed as current, and after the Mister episode, I was certain it was well protected. I saw a paralegal scanning blueprints at a desk next to a secretarial pool, and I asked him where I might find the office of Braden Chance. He nodded to an open door across the hall. To my surprise, Chance was at his desk, projecting the appearance of a very busy lawyer. He was perturbed by my intrusion, and rightfully so. Proper protocol would have been for me to call ahead and set up a meeting. I wasn't worried about protocol. He didn't ask me to sit. I did so anyway, and that didn't help his mood.
"You were one of the hostages," he said irritably when he made the connection.
"Yes, I was."
"Must have been awful."
"It's over. The guy with the gun, the late Mr. Hardy, was evicted from a warehouse on February 4. Was it one of our evictions?"
"It was," he snapped.
Because of his defensiveness, I guessed the file had been picked through during the day. He'd probably reviewed it thoroughly with Arthur and the brass.
"What about it?"
"Was he a squatter?"
"Damn sure was. They're all squatters. Our client is trying to clean up some of that mess."
"Are you sure he was a squatter?" His chin dropped, and his eyes turned red. Then he took a breath.
"What are you after?"
"Could I see the file?"
"No, it's none of your business."
"Maybe it is."
"Who is your supervising partner?"
He yanked out his pen as if to take down the name of the person who would reprimand me. "Rudolph Mays." He wrote in large strokes.
"I'm very busy," he said. "Would you please leave?"
"Why can't I see the file?"
"Because it's mine, and I said no. How's that?"
"Maybe that's not good enough."
"It's good enough for you. Why don't you leave?"
He stood, his hand shaking as he pointed to the door. I smiled at him and left. The paralegal heard everything, and we exchanged puzzled looks as I passed his desk.
"What an ass,"
he said very quietly, almost mouthing the words. I smiled again and nodded my agreement. An ass and a fool. If Chance had been pleasant and explained that Arthur or some other honcho from above had ordered the file sealed, then I wouldn't have been as suspicious. But it was obvious there was something in the file. Getting it would be the challenge. With all the cell phones Claire and I owned, pocket, purse, and car, not to mention a couple of pagers, communication should have been a simple matter. But nothing was simple with our marriage. We hooked up around 9. She was exhausted from another one of her days, which were inevitably more fatiguing than anything I could possibly have done. It was a game we shamelessly played. My job is more important because I'm a doctor, lawyer. I was tiring of the games. I could tell she was pleased that my brush with death had produced aftershocks, that I'd left the office to wander the streets. No doubt her day had been far more productive than mine. Her goal was to become the greatest female neurosurgeon in the country, a brain surgeon even males would turn to when all hope was lost. She was a brilliant student, fiercely determined, blessed with enormous stamina. She would bury the men just as she was slowly burying me, a well-seasoned marathon man from the halls of Drake and Sweeney. The race was getting old. She drove a Miata sports car, no four-wheel drive, and I was worried about her in the bad weather. She would be through in an hour, and it would take that long for me to drive to Georgetown Hospital. I would pick her up there, and we would try to find a restaurant. If not, it would be Chinese carryout, our standard fare. I began arranging papers and objects on my desk, careful to ignore the neat row of my 10 most current files. I kept only 10 on my desk, a method I'd learned from Rudolph, and I spent time with each file every day. Billing was a factor. My top 10 invariably included the wealthiest clients, regardless of how pressing their legal problems. Another trick from Rudolph. I was expected to bill 2,500 hours a year. That's 50 hours a week, 50 weeks a year. My average billing rate was $300 an hour, so I would gross for my beloved firm a total of $750,000. They paid me $120,000 of this, plus another $30,000 for benefits, and assigned $200,000 to the overhead. The partners kept the rest, divided annually, by some horrendously complex formula that usually caused fistfights. It was rare for one of the partners to earn less than $1 million a year, and some earned over two. And once I became a partner, I would be a partner for life. So if I made it when I was 35, which happened to be the fast track I was on, then I could expect 30 years of glorious earnings and immense wealth. That was the dream that kept us at our desks at all hours of the day and night. I was scribbling these numbers, something I did all the time, and something I suspect every lawyer in our firm did, when the phone rang. It was Mordecai Green. "Mr. Brock," he said politely, his voice clearly audible but competing with a din in the background. "Yes, please call me Michael." "Very well. Look, I made some calls, and you have nothing to worry about. The blood test was negative." "Thank you." "Don't mention it. Just thought you'd want to know as soon as possible." "Thanks," I said again, as the racket rose behind him. "Where are you?"
"At a homeless shelter. A big snow brings them in faster than we can feed them, so it takes all of us to keep up. Gotta run."
The desk was old mahogany. The rug was Persian. The chairs were a rich crimson leather. The technology was state-of-the-art. And as I studied my finely appointed office, I wondered for the first time in many years there how much all of it cost. Weren't we just chasing money? Why did we work so hard to buy a richer rug, an older desk? There, in the warmth and coziness of my beautiful room, I thought of Mordecai Green, who at that moment was volunteering his time in a busy shelter, serving food to the cold and hungry, no doubt with a warm smile and a pleasant word. Both of us had law degrees, both of us had passed the same bar exam, both of us were fluent in the tongue of legalese. We were kindred to some degree. I helped my clients swallow up competitors so they could add more zeros to the bottom line, and for this I would become rich. He helped his clients eat and find a warm bed. I looked at the scratchings on my legal pad, the earnings and the years and the path to wealth, and I was saddened by them. Such blatant and unashamed greed. The phone startled me. "Why are you at the office?" Claire asked, each word spoken slowly, because each word was covered with ice. I looked in disbelief at my watch. A client called from the West Coast. It's not snowing out there. I think it was a lie I'd used before. It didn't matter.
"I am waiting, Michael. Should I walk?"
"No, I'll be there as fast as I can." I'd kept her waiting before. It was part of the game. We were much too busy to be prompt. I ran from the building into the storm, not really too concerned that another night had been ruined. Chapter 6. The snow had finally stopped. Claire and I sipped our coffee by the kitchen window. I was reading the paper by the light of a brilliant morning sun. They had managed to keep National Airport open. "Let's go to Florida," I said. "Now." She gave me a withering look.
"Florida?"
"Okay, the Bahamas. We can be there by early afternoon."
"There's no way."
"Sure there is. I'm not going to work for a few days, and
why not?"
"Because I'm cracking up. And around the firm, if you crack up, then you get a few days off."
"You are cracking up."
"I know. It's kind of fun, really. People give you space, treat you with velvet gloves, kiss your ass. Might as well make the most of it." The tight face returned, and she said,
"I can't."
And that was the end of that. It was a whim, and I knew she had too many obligations. It was a cruel thing to do, I decided, as I returned to the paper. But I didn't feel bad about it. She wouldn't have gone with me under any circumstances. She was suddenly in a hurry. Appointments, classes, rounds, the life of an ambitious young surgical resident. She showered and changed and was ready to go. I drove her to the hospital. We didn't talk as we inched through the snow-filled streets.
I'm going to Memphis for a couple of days, I said matter-of-factly when we arrived at the hospital entrance on Reservoir Street.
Oh, really? She said with no discernible reaction. I need to see my parents. It's been almost a year. I figure this is a good time. I don't do well in snow, and I'm not in the mood for work. Cracking up, you know.
Well, call me, she said, opening her door. Then she shut it. No kiss, no goodbye, no concern.
I watched her hurry down the sidewalk and disappear into the building.
It was over, and I hated to tell my mother.
My parents were in their early 60s, both healthy and trying gamely to enjoy forced retirement. Dad was an airline pilot for 30 years. Mom had been a bank manager. They worked hard, saved well, and provided a comfortable upper-middle-class home for us. My two brothers and I had the best private schools we could get into. They were solid people, conservative, patriotic, free of bad habits, fiercely devoted to each other. They went to church on Sundays, the parade on July the 4th, Rotary Club once a week, and they traveled whenever they wanted. They were still grieving over my brother Warner's divorce 3 years earlier. He was an attorney in Atlanta who married his college sweetheart, a Memphis girl from a family we knew. After two kids, the marriage went south. His wife got custody and moved to Portland. My parents got to see the grandkids once a year, if all went well. It was a subject I never brought up. I rented a car at the Memphis airport and drove east into the sprawling suburbs where the white people lived. The blacks had the city, the whites the suburbs. Sometimes the blacks would move into a subdivision and the whites would move to another one farther away. Memphis crept eastward, the races running from each other. My parents lived on a golf course in a new glass house designed so that every window overlooked a fairway. I hated the house because the fairway was always busy. I didn't express my opinions, though. I had called from the airport, so Mother was waiting with great anticipation when I arrived. Dad was on the back nine somewhere. "You look tired," she said after the hug and kiss. It was her standard greeting. "Thanks, Mom. You look great." And she did, slender and bronze from her daily tennis and tanning regimen at the country club. She fixed iced tea and we drank it on the patio, where we watched other retirees fly down the fairway in their golf carts. "What's wrong?" she said before a minute passed, before I took the first sip.
Nothing. I'm fine.
Where's Claire? You guys never call us, you know. I haven't heard her voice in 2 months.
Claire's fine, Mom. We're both alive and healthy and working very hard.
Are you spending enough time together?
No.
Are you spending any time together?
Not much. She frowned and rolled her eyes with motherly concern.
Are you having trouble? She asked, on the attack.
Yes.
I knew it. I knew it. I could tell by your voice on the phone that something was wrong. Surely you're not headed for a divorce, too. Have you tried counseling?
No. Slow down.
Then why not? She's a wonderful person, Michael. Give the marriage everything you have.
We're trying, Mother, but it's difficult.
Affairs? Drugs? Alcohol? Gambling? Any of the bad things?
No, just two people going their separate ways. I work 80 hours a week. She works the other 80.
Then slow down. Money isn't everything.
Her voice broke just a little, and I saw wetness in her eyes. I'm sorry, Mom. At least we don't have kids. She bit her lip and tried to be strong, but she was dying inside. And I knew exactly what she was thinking. Two down, one to go. She would take my divorce as a personal failure. The same way she broke down with my brothers, she would find some way to blame herself. I didn't want the pity. To move things along to more interesting matters, I told her the story of Mister, and for her benefit, downplayed the danger I'd been in. If the story made the Memphis paper, my parents had missed it. "Are you all right?" she asked, horrified. "Of course. The bullet missed me. I'm here." "Oh, thank God. I mean, well, emotionally, are you all right?"
"Yes, Mother. I'm all together, no broken pieces. The firm wanted me to take a couple of days off, so I came home."
"You poor thing. Claire, and now this."
"I'm fine. We had a lot of snow last night, and it was a good time to leave."
"Is Claire safe?"
"As safe as anybody in Washington. She lives at the hospital, probably the smartest place to be in that city."
"I worry about you so much. I see the crime statistics, you know. It's a very dangerous city."
"Almost as dangerous as Memphis. We watched a ball land near the patio and waited for its owner to appear. A stout lady rolled out of a golf cart, hovered over the ball for a second, then shanked it badly. Mother left to get more tea and to wipe her eyes. I don't know which of my parents got the worst end of my visit. My mother wanted strong families with lots of grandchildren. My father wanted his boys to move quickly up the ladder and enjoy the rewards of our hard-earned success. Late that afternoon, my dad and I did 9 holes. He played, I drank beer and drove the cart. Golf had yet to work its magic on me. 2 cold ones, and I was ready to talk. I had repeated the Mr. tale over lunch, so he figured I was just loafing for a couple of days, collecting myself before I roared back into the arena. "I'm getting kind of sick of the big firm, Dad," I said as we sat by the 3rd tee, waiting for the foursome ahead to clear. I was nervous, and my nervousness irritated me greatly. It was my life, not his.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Means I'm tired of what I'm doing."
"Welcome to the real world. You think the guy working a drill press in a factory doesn't get tired of what he's doing? At least you're getting rich."
So he took round 1, almost by a knockout. 2 holes later, as we stopped through the rough looking for his ball, he said,
"Are you changing jobs?"
"Thinking about it."
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know. It's too early. I haven't been looking for another position."
"Then how do you know the grass is greener if you haven't been looking?"
He picked up his ball and walked off. I drove alone on the narrow paved trail while he stalked down the fairway chasing his shot. And I wondered why that gray-haired man out there scared me so much. He had pushed all of his sons to set goals, work hard, strive to be big men, with everything aimed at making lots of money and living the American dream. He had certainly paid for anything we needed. Like my brothers, I was not born with a social conscience. We gave offerings to the church because the Bible strongly suggests it. We paid taxes to the government because the law requires it. Surely, somewhere in the midst of all this giving, some good would be done, and we had a hand in it. Politics belonged to those willing to play that game, and besides, there was no money to be made by honest people. We were taught to be productive, and the more success we attained, the more society would benefit in some way. Set goals, work hard, play fair, achieve prosperity. That's why I was afraid of him. He had a low level of intolerance. He double-bogeyed the 5th hole and was blaming it on his putter when he climbed into the cart. "Maybe I'm not looking for greener pastures," I said.
"Why don't you just go ahead and say what you're trying to say?" he said.
As usual, I felt weak for not facing the issue boldly. "I'm thinking about public interest law."
"What the hell is that?"
"It's when you work for the good of society without making a lot of money."
"What are you, a Democrat now? You've been in Washington too long."
"There are lots of Republicans in Washington. In fact, they've taken over." We rode to the next tee in silence. He was a good golfer, but his shots were getting worse. I'd broken his concentration. Stomping through the rough again, he said,
"So some wino gets his head blown off, and you gotta change society, is that it?"
"He wasn't a wino. He fought in Vietnam. Dad flew B-52s in the early years of Vietnam, and this stopped him cold.
but only for a second. It wasn't about to yield an inch.
One of those, huh?
I didn't respond. The ball was hopelessly lost, and he wasn't really looking. He flipped another onto the fairway, hooked it badly, and away we went.
I hate to see you blow a good career, son, he said. You've worked too hard. You'll be a partner in a few years.
Maybe.
You need some time off, that's all. That seemed to be everybody's remedy.
I took them to dinner at a nice restaurant. We worked hard to avoid the topics of Claire, my career, and the grandkids they seldom saw. We talked about old friends and old neighborhoods. I caught up on the gossip, none of which interested me in the least. I left them at noon on Friday, 4 hours before my flight, and I headed back to my muddled life in D.C. Chapter 7. Of course, the apartment was empty when I returned Friday night, but with a new twist. There was a note on the kitchen counter. Following my cue, Claire had gone home to Providence for a couple of days. No reason was given. She asked me to phone when I got home. I called her parents and interrupted dinner. We labored through a 5-minute chat, in which it was determined that both of us were indeed fine. Memphis was fine, and so was Providence. The families were fine, and she would return sometime Sunday afternoon. I hung up, fixed coffee, and drank a cup, staring out of the bedroom window, watching the traffic crawl along P Street, still covered with snow. If any of the snow had melted, it wasn't obvious. I suspected Claire was telling her parents the same dismal story I had burdened mine with. It was sad and odd, and yet somehow not surprising that we were being honest with our families before we faced the truth ourselves. I was tired of it and determined that one day, very soon, perhaps as early as Sunday, we would sit somewhere, probably at the kitchen table, and confront reality. We would lay bare our feelings and fears and, I was quite sure, start planning our separate futures. I knew she wanted out. I just didn't know how badly. I practiced the words I would say to her out loud until they sounded convincing, and I went for a long walk. It was 10 degrees with a sharp wind, and the chill cut through my trench coat. I passed the handsome homes and cozy row houses where I saw real families eating and laughing and enjoying the warmth, and moved on to M Street, where throngs of those suffering from cabin fever filled the sidewalks. Even a freezing Friday night on M was never dull. The bars were packed, the restaurants had waiting lines, the coffee shops were filled. I stood at the window of a music club, listening to the blues with snow packed around my ankles, watching the young couples drink and dance. For the first time in my life, I felt like something other than a young person. I was 32, but in the last 7 years I had worked more than most people do in 20. I was tired, not old, but bearing down hard on middle age, and I admitted that I was no longer fresh from college. Those pretty girls in there would never look twice at me now. I was frozen, and it was snowing again. I bought a sandwich, stuffed it into a pocket, and slogged my way back to the apartment. I fixed a strong drink and a small fire, and I ate in the semi-darkness, very much alone. In the old days, Claire's absence for the weekend would have given me guilt-free grounds to live at the office. Sitting by the fire, I was repulsed by that thought. Drake and Sweeney would be standing proudly long after I was gone, and the clients and their problems, which had seemed so crucial, would be tended to by other squads of young lawyers. My departure would be a slight bump in the road for the firm, scarcely noticeable. My office would be taken minutes after I walked out. At some time after 9, the phone rang, jolting me from a long, somber daydream. It was Mordecai Green, speaking loudly into a cell phone. "Are you busy?" he asked.
Not exactly. What's going on?"
"It's cold as hell, snowing again, and we're short on manpower. Do you have a few hours to spare?"
"To do what?"
"To work. We really need able bodies down here. The shelters and soup kitchens are packed, and we don't have enough volunteers."
I'm not sure I'm qualified.
Can you spread peanut butter on bread?
I think so.
Then you're qualified.
Okay, where do I go?
We're 10 blocks or so from the office. At the intersection of 13th and Euclid, you'll see a yellow church on your right. Ebenezer Christian Fellowship. We're in the basement.
I scribbled this down, each word getting shakier, because Mordecai was calling me into a combat zone. I wanted to ask if I should pack a gun. I wondered if he carried one. But he was black, and I wasn't. What about my car, my prized Lexus?
Got that? He growled after a pause.
Yeah, be there in 20 minutes, I said bravely, my heart already pounding. I changed into jeans, a sweatshirt, and designer hiking boots. I took the credit cards and most of the cash out of my wallet. In the top of a closet, I found an old wool-lined denim jacket stained with coffee and paint, a relic from law school, and as I modeled it in the mirror, I hoped it made me look non-affluent. It did not. If a young actor wore it on the cover of Vanity Fair, a trend would start immediately. I desperately wanted a bulletproof vest. I was scared. But as I locked the door and stepped into the snow, I was also strangely excited. The drive-by shootings and gang attacks I had expected did not materialize. The weather kept the streets empty and safe for the moment. I found the church and parked in a lot across the street. It looked like a small cathedral, at least 100 years old, and no doubt abandoned by its original congregation. Around a corner, I saw some men huddled together waiting by a door. I brushed past them as if I knew exactly where I was going, and I entered the world of the homeless. As badly as I wanted to barge ahead, to pretend I had seen this before and had work to do, I couldn't move. I gawked in amazement at the sheer number of poor people stuffed into the basement. Some were lying on the floor, trying to sleep. Some were sitting in groups, talking in low tones. Some were eating at long tables, and others in their folding chairs. Every square inch along the walls was covered with people sitting with their backs to the cinder blocks. Small children cried and played as their mothers tried to keep them close. Winos lay rigid, snoring through it all. Volunteers passed out blankets and walked among the throngs handing out apples. The kitchen was at one end, bustling with action as food was prepared and served. I could see Mordecai in the background, pouring fruit juice into paper cups, talking incessantly. A line waited patiently at the serving tables. The room was warm, and the odors and aromas and the gas heat mixed to create a thick smell that was not unpleasant. A homeless man, bundled up much like Mister, bumped into me, and it was time to move. I went straight to Mordecai, who was delighted to see me. We shook hands like old friends, and he introduced me to 2 volunteers whose names I never heard.
"It's crazy," he said. "A big snow, a cold snap, and we work all night. Grab that bread over there."
He pointed to a tray of sliced white bread, which I took and followed him to a table.
"It's real complicated. You got bologna here, mustard and mayo there. Half the sandwiches get mustard, half get mayo, 1 slice of bologna, 2 slices of bread. Do a dozen with peanut butter every now and then. Got it?"
"Yeah."
"You catch on quick."
He slapped me on the shoulder and disappeared. I hurriedly made 10 sandwiches and declared myself to be proficient. Then I slowed and began to watch the people as they waited in line, their eyes downcast but always glancing at the food ahead. They were handed a paper plate, plastic bowl and spoon, and a napkin. As they shuffled along, the bowl was filled with soup, half a sandwich was placed on the plate, then an apple and a small cookie were added. A cup of apple juice was waiting at the end. Most of them said a quiet thanks to the volunteer handing out the juice. Then they moved away, gingerly holding the plate and bowl. Even the children were still and careful with their food. Most seemed to eat slowly, savoring the warmth and feel of food in their mouths, the aroma in their faces. Others ate as fast as possible. Next to me was a gas stove with four burners, each with a large pot of soup cooking away. On the other side of it, a table was covered with celery, carrots, onions, tomatoes, and whole chickens. A volunteer with a large knife was chopping and dicing with a vengeance. Two more volunteers manned the stove. Several hauled the food to the serving tables. For the moment, I was the only sandwich man.
"We need more peanut butter sandwiches," Mordecai announced as he returned to the kitchen. He reached under the table and grabbed a 2-gallon jug of generic peanut butter. "Can you handle it?"
"I'm an expert," I said. He watched me work. The line was momentarily short. He wanted to talk.
"I thought you were a lawyer," I said, spreading peanut butter. "I'm a human first, then a lawyer. It's possible to be both. Not quite so much on the spread there. We have to be efficient."
"Where does the food come from?"
"Food bank. It's all donated. Tonight we're lucky because we have chicken. That's a delicacy. Usually it's just vegetables."
"This bread is not too fresh."
"Yes, but it's free. Comes from a large bakery. They're day-old stuff. You can have a sandwich if you like."
"Thanks, I just had one. Do you eat here?"
"Rarely."
From the looks of his girth, Mordecai had not maintained a diet of vegetable soup and apples. He sat on the edge of the table and studied the crowd.
"Is this your first trip to a shelter?"
"Yep."
"What's the first word that comes to mind?"
"Hopeless."
"That's predictable, but you'll get over it."
"How many people live here?"
"None. This is just an emergency shelter. The kitchen is open every day for lunch and dinner, but it's not technically a shelter. The church is kind enough to open its doors when the weather is bad."
I tried to understand this. "Then where do these people live?"
"Some are squatters. They live in abandoned buildings, and they're the lucky ones. Some live on the streets, some in parks, some in bus stations, some under bridges. They can survive there as long as the weather is tolerable. Tonight they would freeze."
"Then where are the shelters?"
"Scattered about. There are about 20, half privately funded, the other half run by the city, which, thanks to the new budget, will soon close 2 of them."
"How many beds?"
5,000, give or take."
"How many homeless?"
"That's always a good question, because they're not the easiest group to count. 10,000 is a good guess."
10,000?
"Yeah, and that's just the people on the street. There are probably another 20,000 living with families and friends a month or two away from homelessness."
"So there are at least 5,000 people on the streets?" I said, my disbelief obvious.
"At least."
A volunteer asked for sandwiches. Mordecai helped me, and we made another dozen. Then we stopped and watched the crowd again. The door opened, and a young mother entered slowly, holding a baby and followed by 3 small children, one of whom wore a pair of shorts and mismatched socks, no shoes. A towel was draped over its shoulders. The other 2 at least had shoes, but little clothing. The baby appeared to be asleep. The mother seemed dazed, and once inside the basement was uncertain where to go next. There was not a spot at a table. She led her family toward the food, and 2 smiling volunteers stepped forward to help. One parked them in a corner near the kitchen and began serving them food, while the other covered them with blankets. Mordecai and I watched the scene develop. I tried not to stare, but who cared?
"What happens to her when the storm is over?" I asked.
"Who knows? Why don't you ask her?"
That put me on the spot. I was not ready to get my hands dirty.
"Are you active in the D.C. Bar Association?" he asked.
"Somewhat. Why?"
"Just curious. The bar does a lot of pro bono work with the homeless."
He was fishing, and I wasn't about to get caught.
"I work on death penalty cases," I said proudly, and somewhat truthfully. 4 years earlier, I'd helped one of our partners write a brief for an inmate in Texas. My firm preached pro bono to all its associates, but the free work had damned well better not interfere with the billings. We kept watching the mother and her 4 children. The 2 toddlers ate their cookies first while the soup was cooling. The mother was either stoned or in shock.
"Is there a place she can go to right now and live?" I asked.
Probably not, Mordecai answered nonchalantly, his large feet swinging from the edge of the table. As of yesterday, the waiting list for emergency shelter had 500 names on it.
For emergency shelter?
Yep. There's one hypothermia shelter the city graciously opens when the temperature drops below freezing. That might be her only chance, but I'm sure it's packed tonight. The city is then kind enough to close the shelter when things thaw.
The sous chef had to leave, and since I was the nearest volunteer who wasn't busy at the moment, I was pressed into duty. While Mordecai made sandwiches, I chopped celery, carrots, and onions for an hour, all under the careful eye of Miss Dolly, one of the founding members of the church who had been in charge of feeding the homeless for 11 years now. It was her kitchen. I was honored to be in it, and I was told at one point that my chunks of celery were too large. They quickly became smaller. Her apron was white and spotless, and she took enormous pride in her work.
"Do you ever get used to seeing these people?" I asked her at one point.
We were standing in front of the stove, distracted by an argument in the back somewhere. Mordecai and the minister intervened, and peace prevailed.
"Never, honey," she said, wiping her hands on a towel. "It still breaks my heart. But in Proverbs it says, 'Happy is the man who feeds the poor.' That keeps me going."
She turned and gently stirred the soup.
"Chicken's ready," she said, in my direction.
"What does that mean?"
"Means you take the chicken off the stove, pour the broth into that pot, let the chicken cool, then bone it."
There was an art to boning, especially using Miss Dolly's method. My fingers were hot and practically blistered when I finished. Chapter 8 Mordecai led me up a dark stairway to the foyer.
"Watch your step," he said, almost in a whisper, as we pushed through a set of swinging doors into the sanctuary.
It was dim because people were trying to sleep everywhere. They were sprawled on the pews, snoring. They were squirming under the pews, mothers trying to make children be still. They were huddled in the aisles, leaving a narrow path for us as we worked our way toward the pulpit. The choir loft was filled with them, too.
"Not many churches will do this," he whispered as we stood near the altar table and surveyed the rows of pews.
I could understand their reluctance.
"What happens Sunday?" I whispered back. "Depends on the weather. The Reverend is one of us. He has, on occasion, canceled worship instead of running them out."
I was not sure what "one of us" meant, but I didn't feel like a member of the club. I heard the ceiling creak and realized that there was a U-shaped balcony above us. I squinted and slowly focused on another mass of humanity layered in the rows of seats up there. Mordecai was looking, too.
"How many people?" I mumbled, unable to finish the thought. "We don't count. We just feed and shelter."
A gust of wind hit the side of the building and rattled the windows. It was considerably colder in the sanctuary than in the basement. We tiptoed over bodies and left through a door by the organ. It was almost 11. The basement was still crowded, but the soup line was gone.
"Follow me," Mordecai said.
He took a plastic bowl and held it forth for a volunteer to fill.
"Let's see how well you cook," he said with a smile.
We sat in the middle of the pack at a folding table with street people at our elbows. He was able to eat and chat as if everything was fine.
I wasn't.
I played with my soup, which, thanks to Miss Dolly, was really quite good, but I couldn't get beyond the fact that I, Michael Brock, an affluent white boy from Memphis and Yale and Drake and Sweeney, was sitting among the homeless in the basement of a church in the middle of Northwest D.C. I had seen one other white face, that of a middle-aged wino who had eaten and disappeared. I was sure my Lexus was gone, certain I could not survive 5 minutes outside the building. I vowed to stick to Mordecai whenever and however he decided to leave.
"This is good soup," he pronounced.
"It varies," he explained.
"Depends on what's available, and the recipe is different from place to place." "I got noodles the other day at Martha's table," said the man sitting to my right.
a man whose elbow was closer to my bowl than my own.
"Noodles?" Mordecai asked, in mock disbelief. "In your soup?"
"Yep. About once a month you get noodles. Of course, everybody knows it now, so it's hard to get a table."
I couldn't tell if he was joking or not, but there was a twinkle in his eye. The idea of a homeless man lamenting the lack of tables in his favorite soup kitchen struck me as humorous. Hard to get a table. How many times had I heard that from friends in Georgetown? Mordecai smiled.
"What's your name?" he asked the man.
I would learn that Mordecai always wanted a name to go with a face. The homeless he loved were more than victims. They were his people. It was a natural curiosity for me, too. I wanted to know how the homeless became homeless. What broke in our vast system of public assistance to allow Americans to become so poor they lived under bridges?
"Drano,"
he said, chomping on one of my larger celery chunks.
"Drano," Mordecai said.
"Drano,"
the man repeated. "What's your last name?"
"Don't have one. Too poor."
"Who gave you the name Drano?"
"My mama."
"How old were you when she gave you the name Drano?"
"About 5.
"Why Drano?"
"She had this baby who wouldn't shut up, cried all the time. Nobody could sleep. I fed it some Drano."
He told the story while stirring his soup. It was well rehearsed, well delivered, and I didn't believe a word of it. But others were listening, and Drano was enjoying himself.
"What happened to the baby?" Mordecai asked, playing the straight guy.
"Dad."
"That would be your brother," Mordecai said.
"Nope, sister."
"I see. So you killed your sister."
"Yeah, but we got plenty of sleep after that."
Mordecai winked at me as if he'd heard similar tales. "Where do you live, Drano?" I asked.
"Here in D.C.
"Where do you stay?"
Mordecai asked, correcting my vernacular.
"Stay here and there. I got a lot of rich women who pay me to keep them company."
Two men on the other side of Drano found this amusing. One snickered, the other laughed.
"Where do you get your mail?" Mordecai asked.
"Post office," he replied.
Drano would have a quick answer for every question, so we left him alone. Miss Dolly made coffee for the volunteers after she had turned off her stove. The homeless were bedding down for the night. Mordecai and I sat on the edge of a table in the darkened kitchen, sipping coffee and looking through the large serving window at the huddled masses. "How late will you stay?" I asked. He shrugged.
"Depends. You get a couple hundred people like this in one room, something usually happens. The Reverend would feel better if I stay."
"All night?"
"I've done it many times."
I hadn't planned on sleeping with these people, nor had I planned on leaving the building without Mordecai to guard me.
"Feel free to leave whenever you want," he said.
Leaving was the worst of my limited options. Midnight, Friday night on the streets of D.C., white boy, beautiful car. Snow or not, I didn't like my odds out there.
"You have a family?" I asked. "Yes. My wife is a secretary in the Department of Labor. 3 sons. One's in college, one's in the Army."
His voice trailed away before he got to son number 3. I wasn't about to ask.
"And one we lost on the streets 10 years ago. Gangs."
"I'm sorry."
"What about you?"
"Married. No kids." I thought about Claire for the first time in several hours. How would she react if she knew where I was? Neither of us had found time for anything remotely related to charity work. She would mumble to herself, "He's really cracking up," or something to that effect. I didn't care.
"What does your wife do?"
he asked, making light conversation. "She's a surgical resident at Georgetown."
"You guys will have a maid, won't you? You'll be a partner in a big firm, she'll be a surgeon. Another American dream."
"I guess." The Reverend appeared from nowhere and pulled Mordecai deep into the kitchen for a hushed conversation. I took 4 cookies from a bowl and walked to the corner where the young mother sat sleeping with her head propped on a pillow and the baby tucked under her arm. The toddlers were motionless under the blankets, but the oldest child was awake. I squatted close to him and held out a cookie. His eyes glowed, and he grabbed it. I watched him eat every bite. Then he wanted another. He was small and bony, no more than 4 years old. The mother's head fell forward, jolting her. She looked at me with sad, tired eyes, then realized I was playing Cookie Man. She offered a faint smile, then rearranged the pillow. "What's your name?" I whispered to the little boy. After two cookies, he was my friend for life.
"Ontario," he said slowly and plainly.
"How old are you?" He held up four fingers, then folded one down, then raised it again. "Four?" I asked. He nodded and extended his hand for another cookie, which I gladly gave him. I would have given him anything.
"Where do you stay?" I whispered. "In a car," he whispered back.
It took a second for this to sink in. I wasn't sure what to ask next. He was too busy eating to worry about conversation. I had asked three questions. He'd given three honest answers. They lived in a car. I wanted to run and ask Mordecai what you do when you find people who live in a car, but I kept smiling at Ontario. He smiled back. He finally said,
"You got more apple juice?"
"Sure," I said, and walked to the kitchen where I filled two cups. He gulped one down, and I handed him the second cup. "Say thanks," I said.
"Thanks,"
he said, and stuck out his hand for another cookie. I found a folding chair and took a position next to Ontario with my back to the wall. The basement was quiet at times, but never still. Those who live without beds do not sleep calmly. Occasionally, Mordecai would pick his way around the bodies to settle some flare-up. He was so large and intimidating that no one dared challenge his authority. With his stomach filled again, Ontario dozed off, his little head resting on his mother's feet. I slipped into the kitchen, poured another cup of coffee, and went back to my chair in the corner. Then the baby erupted. Its pitiful voice wailed forth with amazing volume, and the entire room seemed to ripple with the noise. The mother was dazed, tired, frustrated at having been aroused from sleep. She told it to shut up, then placed it on her shoulder and rocked back and forth. It cried louder, and there were rumblings from the other campers. With a complete lack of sense or thought, I reached over and took the child, smiling at the mother as I did so in an attempt to win her confidence. She didn't care. She was relieved to get rid of it. The child weighed nothing, and the damn thing was soaking wet. I realized this as I gently placed its head on my shoulder and began patting its rear. I moved to the kitchen, desperately searching for Mordecai or another volunteer to rescue me. Miss Dolly had left an hour earlier. To my relief and surprise, the child grew quiet as I walked around the stove, patting and cooing and looking for a towel or something. My hand was soaked. Where was I? What the hell was I doing? What would my friends think if they could see me in the dark kitchen humming to a little street baby, praying that the diaper was only wet? I didn't smell anything foul, though I was certain I could feel lice jumping from its head to mine. My best friend Mordecai appeared and turned on a switch.
"How cute," he said.
"Do we have any diapers?" I hissed at him.
"Big job or little job?"
he asked happily, walking toward the cabinets.
"I don't know. Just hurry."
He pulled out a pack of Pampers, and I thrust the child at him. My denim jacket had a large wet spot on the left shoulder. With incredible deftness, he placed the baby on the cutting board, removed the wet diaper, revealing a baby girl, cleaned her with a wipe of some sort, re-diapered her with a fresh Pamper, then thrust her back at me. "There she is," he said proudly. "Good as new." "The things they don't teach you in law school," I said, taking the child. I paced the floor with her for an hour until she fell asleep. I wrapped her in my jacket and gently placed her between her mother and Ontario. It was almost 3 a.m. Saturday, and I had to go. My freshly pricked conscience could take only so much in one day. Mordecai walked me to the street, thanked me for coming, and sent me away, coatless, into the night. My car was sitting where I left it, covered with new snow. He was standing in front of the church, watching me as I drove away. Chapter 9. Since my run-in with Mister on Tuesday, I had not billed a single hour for dear old Drake and Sweeney. I'd been averaging 200 a month for 5 years, which meant 8 per day for 6 days with a couple left over. No day could be wasted and precious few hours left unaccounted for. When I fell behind, which rarely happened, I would work 12 hours on a Saturday and perhaps do the same on a Sunday. And if I wasn't behind, I will do only 7 or 8 hours on Saturday and just a few on Sunday. No wonder Claire went to med school. As I stared at the bedroom ceiling late Saturday morning, I was almost paralyzed with inaction. I did not want to go to the office. I hated the thought. I dreaded the neat little rows of pink phone messages Polly had on my desk, the memos from higher-ups arranging meetings to inquire about my well-being, the nosy chit-chat from the gossipers, and the inevitable "how you doing" from friends and those genuinely concerned and those who couldn't care less. What I dreaded most, though, was the work. Antitrust cases are long and arduous, with files so thick they require boxes. And what was the point anyway? $1 billion corporation fighting another, 100 lawyers involved, all cranking out paper. I admitted to myself that I'd never loved the work. It was a means to an end. If I practiced it with a fury, became a whiz, and perfected a specialty, then one day soon I would be in demand. It could have been tax, or labor, or litigation. Who could love antitrust law? By sheer will, I forced myself out of bed and into the shower. Breakfast was a croissant from a bakery on M with strong coffee, all taken with one hand on the wheel. I wondered what Ontario was having for breakfast. Then told myself to stop the torture. I had the right to eat without feeling guilty. But food was losing its importance for me. The radio said the day's high would be 20 degrees, the low near zero, with no more snow for a week. I made it as far as the building's lobby before being accosted by one of my brethren. Bruce somebody from communications stepped onto the elevator when I did and said gravely, "How you doing, pal?" "Fine, you?" I shot back. "Okay. Look, we're pulling for you, you know? Hang in there." I nodded as if his support was crucial. Mercifully, he left on the second floor, but not before favoring me with a locker room pat on the shoulder. "Give him hell, Bruce." I was damaged goods. My steps were slower as I passed Madame Devier's desk in the conference room. I went down the marble hallway until I found my office and slumped into the leather swivel, exhausted. Polly had several ways of leaving behind the phone litter. If I had been diligent in returning calls, and if she happened to be pleased with my efforts, she would leave one or two message slips near my phone. If, however, I had not, and if this happened to displease her, then she liked nothing better than to line them up in the center of my desk, a sea of pink, all perfectly arranged in chronological order. I counted 39 messages, several urgent, several from the brass. Rudolph especially seemed to be irritated, judging by Polly's trail. I read them slowly as I collected them, then set them aside. I was determined to finish my coffee, in peace and without pressure, and so I was sitting at my desk, holding the cup with both hands, staring into the unknown, looking very much like someone teetering on the edge of a cliff, when Rudolph walked in. The spies must have called him, a paralegal on the lookout, or maybe Bruce from the elevator. Perhaps the entire firm was on alert. No, they were too busy. "Hello, Mike," he said crisply, taking a seat, crossing his legs, settling in for serious business. "Hi, Rudy," I said. I had never called him Rudy to his face. It was always Rudolph. His current wife and the partners called him Rudy, but no one else. "Where have you been?" he asked, without the slightest hint of compassion.
Memphis.
Memphis. Yeah, I needed to see my parents, plus the family shrink is there.
A shrink?
Yes, he observed me for a couple of days.
Observed you?
Yeah, in one of those swanky little units with Persian rugs and salmon for dinner, $1,000 a day.
For 2 days? You were in for 2 days?
Yeah. The lying didn't bother me, nor did I feel bad because the lying didn't bother me. The firm can be harsh, even ruthless, when it decides to be, and I was in no mood for an ass-chewing from Rudolph. He had marching orders from the executive committee, and he would make a report minutes after leaving my office. If I could thaw him, the report would go soft, the brass would relax, life would be easier for the short term.
You should have called somebody, he said, still hard, but the crack was coming.
Come on, Rudolph, I was locked down, no phones. There was just enough agony in my voice to soften him.
After a long pause, he said, Are you okay?
I'm fine.
You're fine.
The shrink said I'm fine.
100%?
110. No problems, Rudolph. I needed a little break, that's all. I'm fine. Back at full throttle.
That was all Rudolph wanted. He smiled and relaxed and said, We have lots of work to do.
I know. I can't wait. He practically ran from my office. He would go straight to the phone and report that one of the firm's many producers was back in the saddle. I locked the door and turned off the lights, then spent a painful hour covering my desk with papers and scribblings. Nothing was accomplished, but at least I was on the clock. When I couldn't stand it any longer, I stuffed the phone messages in my pocket and walked out. I escaped without getting caught.
I stopped at a large discount pharmacy on Massachusetts and had a delightful shopping spree. Candy and small toys for the kids, soap and toiletries for the mall, socks and sweatpants in a variety of children's sizes, a large carton of Pampers. I had never had so much fun spending $200. And I would spend whatever was necessary to get them into a warm place. If it was a motel for a month, no problem. They would soon become my clients, and I would threaten and litigate with a vengeance until they had adequate housing. I couldn't wait to sue somebody. I parked across from the church, much less afraid than I had been the night before, but still sufficiently scared. Wisely, I left the care packages in the car. If I walked in like Santa Claus, it would start a riot. My intentions were to leave there with the family, take them to a motel, check them in, make sure they were bathed and cleaned and disinfected, then feed them until they were stuffed, see if they needed medical attention, maybe take them to get shoes and warm clothes, then feed them again. I didn't care what it would cost or how long it might take. Nor did I care if people thought I was just another rich white guy working off a little guilt. Miss Dolly was pleased to see me. She said hello and pointed to a pile of vegetables with skins in need of removal. First, though, I checked on Ontario and family and couldn't find them. They were not in their spot. So I roamed through the basement, stepping over and around dozens of street people. They were not in the sanctuary nor in the balcony. I chatted with Miss Dolly as I peeled potatoes. She remembered the family from last night, but they had already left when she arrived around 9. Where would they go? I wondered.
Honey, these people move. They go from kitchen to kitchen, shelter to shelter. Maybe she heard they're giving out cheese over in Brightwood or Blanket somewhere. She might even have a job at McDonald's and she leaves the kids with her sister. You never know. But they don't stay in one place.
This book is continued on Disc 3.